Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Classical Liberalism. Recorded in 1995, Dr. James M. Buchanan, Harris University professor at George Mason University, and Dr. Charles K. Rowley, general director of the Locke Institute and professor of economics at George Mason University, discuss the question of where classical liberalism stands in a civil society. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Charles, I thought we might share today sort of a general perspective on where classical liberalism stands. I know that you have thought a lot about this, and I know that you're working on a dictionary of classical liberalism. Before we get started in perhaps in the perspective, I think it might be useful if you would just tell us a little bit about what this dictionary is and what your project is in that sense. And then we can go on from there, talk about the more general perspective.
Well, the project itself is quite an ambitious one because it spans the whole period from the early or mid 17th century right through to the present time. And what I've tried to do are to pick out those really significant classical liberal political philosophers and economists. And the problem being that, of course, if you want to have both political philosophy and economics, then you are narrowing the field quite considerably. And as it turns out, and this is a very interesting... Are we started yet?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry. As it turns out, one can almost trace the path of classical liberalism in terms of the number of people that come into the dictionary at various times. We start essentially with John Locke, and in the 17th century there are five. And then you move into the 18th century and it picks up pace, and of course notably with Adam Smith, and there are 10 people who make it into the dictionary at that time. And then you move into the 19th century, and this is the great peak period of classical liberalism with 22 names. And we move into the 20th century, and there are only five. Mm-hmm. And those five are all Americans. Mm-hmm. I think this is a very significant indication of, in a sense,
where
decline
we stand.
And fall.
Yeah. Well, how many names then you have total?
42.
I see. And then there are sort of essays on each of these intellectual biographies, so
yes,
to speak.
There is a biography and a bibliography.
I see.
And I think it is important that one shouldn't take in writing a dictionary of this kind one's own particular vision of mm-hmm. classical liberalism. The dictionary should be allowed to breathe. And of course, we do see different traits and facets. I mean, we have the mercantilists, essentially, with Locke and physiocrats in the early phase, and then you move into the what I would call the great classical liberal tradition of Hume and Smith, and then through into a little bit more of a dogmatic classical liberalism with people like Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill. And then you have the Austrian tradition of Menger and Mises and Hayek, and then ultimately, of course, the contractarian tradition that you've been so important to.
Well, I think that's a very interesting project. Let's now shift and talk about where classical liberalism stands. As you suggested, there has not been as much a representation of that position in this century as earlier. But yet you would think that with the demise of socialism, you would find a resurgence. And of course, this is what Francis Fukuyama predicted in his book, The End of History, and The Last Man explicitly predicted that one of the results would be a validation of the sort of scientific content of classical liberalism. That does not seem to have happened, and as a matter of fact, of course it's early, but still, but as a matter of fact, some people who were previously on board, so to speak, in the classical liberalism now seem to have defected, and I just wonder what you think about that. How do you interpret the fact that classical liberalism has not really picked itself up off the floor, so to speak, intellectually? And as if anything, has not gained adherence. Yet we've had this demonstrable experience of this century with socialism.
I think that you made a very interesting commentary in one of your papers, where you commented that one of the impacts of the collapse of the Soviet Empire was that socialism in the large, perhaps forever, had been destroyed, but that socialism in the small still remained with us. And I think that was the point that Fukuyama failed to recognize in that early rush to the belief that that one tradition had survived. Notably, I think the two philosophers who, in a sense, departed from the classical liberal camp, kind of ironically, in 1989, were Robert Nozick and John Gray. Mm-hmm. And I have some views on that, and I think perhaps it might be appropriate to develop them. It seems to me that throughout all of time, there have been two dichotomies that have dominated debate. And they are quite separate dichotomies, but many people fail to see that they are separate. One is, if you like, and I put it just simply now to make the point, the Hobbesian tradition, which I think is the anarchy versus order dichotomy. And the second, let's call it the Lockean tradition, is the freedom versus oppression dichotomy. And it seems to me that many of our present-day scholars, and I think I would say particularly John Gray, mm-hmm. has shifted from an early focus on the I wouldn't say the Lockean, because he isn't a Lockean, but on the freedom versus oppression dimension into this alternative viewpoint. If one looks back at his work, for example, the early work on, he is a great scholar of Mill. And at one stage in his writings on Mill, he said that this was a very fundamental work that we should all, as classical liberals, refer to and draw sustenance from. His work on Isaiah Berlin focused very much on negative liberty and negative freedom. And this, of course, is right in the freedom oppression mm-hmm. dimension, although it does have value pluralism, which is, I think, mm-hmm. part of the reason that has led to the shift. Mm-hmm. And then his work on Hayek, he criticizes Hayek for the lack of a philosophy and for relying on evolution. Mm-hmm. And then we see the change over to the notion that there is no philosophy of classical liberalism which has meaning, and to the notion that all that we're left with is civil society in some broad tent mm-hmm. sense. Now, it's interesting that in his later book on post-liberalisms, he refers to your work. He refers to mm-hmm. your work on contractarianism, and he refers to it favorably, but he misunderstands, I think, the thrust of your contribution. He talks about the Hobbesian background, and he forgets that in The Limits of Liberty, you were extremely careful, although you did start from the Hobbesian mm-hmm. framework, to put it into the classical liberal mm-hmm. tradition. And you do end up with a very strong philosophical argument for the limited state mm-hmm. between anarchy and Leviathan. Yeah. And John Gray takes the Hobbesian notion, and in a sense, he then falls into the Hobbesian trap. That if you really focus on the Hobbesian model without making the kind of adjustments that you make, you end up on that anarchy versus oppression mm-hmm. dimension. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's taken him to this emphasis now on order that I think dominates his viewpoint.
I think that's a proper interpretation. And in some discussions with John Gray, I know, in fact, that he has been concerned, as all of us have been concerned, I suspect, and we might get into that a little bit, with what he observes to be a kind of a breakdown of civil order. And then you compliment me by saying I didn't fall into that trap, so to speak, but one reason may be that I simply abstracted more from what I saw around me, whereas it seems to me that John Gray has been impressed a lot, and it has affected his thinking by observing a breakdown of sort of established traditions, established rules, and influence again by Oakeshott and Berlin to some extent. He has picked up on that strand of the importance of traditions and so forth and so on. That seems to me, I think your explanation is quite right. And yet we don't find much of a resurgence, an offset coming from anyone in this tradition, and even Hayek now, and let's talk about that a little bit if you'd like. Many people are now placing their primary emphasis on interpreting the late Hayek as opposed to the classical liberal Hayek. Now, as you know, one of the highest points of Hayek's work in terms of a criteria of classical liberalism was the Constitution of Liberty, which he published in 1960. But then as his work progressed and as he lived longer, his last book, which culminated in The Fatal Conceit, which was actually posthumously written or at least past the time that Hayek was productive, and worked out by William Bartley, that shifts to this evolutionary perspective. And many people are concerned that Hayek, the classical liberal, is forgotten, and now people are interpreting Hayek primarily as an evolutionist. And that sort of undermines Hayek's influence, so to speak.
I think you're right. And for myself, I always go back to the Constitution of Liberty as the great Hayekian work, together with his earlier work on information and so on. But I think that there were two factors. One, that his emphasis on the common law, and he was so concerned by what he saw happening through Europe and the breakdown and the erosion of what he calls nomos, the law of liberty, that I think he perhaps fell into a little bit of a trap of defending nomos and its course wherever it goes. And I mean, it's quite clear to me that, for example, that the evolution of the law of tort, particularly in this country, has not followed classical liberal lines. And I think a younger Hayek looking back now would have recognized that force. But I think he was trapped somewhat in the mid-20th century role of the law of tort, where it was very much, of course, a classical liberal tradition. And now, I have my own views on the fatal conceit. I don't think that Hayek really wrote the fatal conceit. And I think that, unfortunately, the fact that Bartley wrote that book for him and that he was not really in a position to read the proofs and to make adjustments probably has shifted the emphasis. And so my view, and it will be my view in the dictionary, is that we should not treat The Fatal Conceit as a Hayekian book, but as a Bartley book. And I think that that, to some extent, does protect the position of Hayek as a classical liberal.
Well, I agree fully with you on one part of that remark, but I disagree categorically on another part. I share with you the view that The Fatal Conceit is basically a Bartley book, and Bartley did really write a lot of that book, and it should not be fully attributed to Hayek. On the other hand, I know from experience that Bartley greatly improved on the Hayek that was in the book. There was a conference that we held that was held in Übergürkel, which was Hayek's summer place he always went every summer for many, many years. And the conference was aimed to sort of encourage him to finish the book and criticize it, the great project that he had started years before. And we went there and we sat around the table, and actually those of us, I think, were unanimous in our view that the book that Hayek presented us with should never have been published. And he sprung on us the notion that, well, he'd already signed a contract and for the first volume. His original idea was to have three volumes, and the other two were just in outline. Well, what Hayek showed us was really much more extreme in terms of the evolutionary, in terms of the population criteria, than the book that finally appeared. So Bartley greatly improved the book. I agree that Bartley really is responsible for the book. It's not Hayek, but on the other hand, the Hayek that would have been in the book would have been worse, so to speak. So I'm halfway on board with you.
Let me kind of moderate my statement then and suggest that perhaps there comes a point in a great scholar's career where he should know when to stop writing.
Right. Quit while he's ahead, so to speak.
Right.
That's true, I think, of all of us. Let's go back a little bit, however, to this double dichotomy that you mentioned, this anarchy, order, liberty, oppression, a notion, and thinking about how John Gray may have modified his attitude and being influenced a lot by Oakeshott and so forth. Let's look at it now from the point of view of a sort of a classical liberal defender of classical liberal. Is it necessary that we sort of say that, look, we must, in order to preserve liberty, we must put up with a lot of disorder. Is civil disorder, as we now observe in many aspects of Western culture, is that a price that we have to pay for liberty, or is that necessary?
I think that depends partly on what kind of classical liberalism one is talking about. I, of course, tend to take the Lockean view. And I think from the Lockean perspective, the answer is a categorical no. Locke, when he talks about liberty, does not talk about license. He talks about liberty as a right and as a duty. And it seems to me that in many aspects where disorder is threatened, it comes because people, individuals, in a sense, abuse their liberty, their own freedom, by abusing the liberties of others. And that's not liberty. That would put an individual in a Lockean context outside of the of natural law. And action could be taken against him. Discipline, of course, either in the state of nature or through civil society, could be taken. So I don't think there's any necessary association of liberty with disorder. And I think that one can reconcile an ordered society with a classical liberal society. But one has to recognize that that will mean a role for the minimal state. I mean, that the state will have a role if there is to be a civil society. The state will have a role to prevent licensed abuse of liberty.
Yeah, those are tricky margins, though. Let's look, for example, in the late 20th century world. And look at Singapore. Now, Singapore, in many respects, qualifies, but on the other hand, there certainly is a very little license there. I mean, the rules are very strict. I think John Gray, go back to what he says, I think he sees the future as being the role for a type of state like Singapore to be much more favorable than, say, a type of state like the United States or Britain today.
I think that goes right back to your view on the nature of man. Yeah. If you have a view of man as essentially Hobbesian, then perhaps you end up with the notion of Singapore as being the only sustainable system. What Singapore does provide are economic rights. It defends the right to property, but it does not give civil and individual rights in the sense that we in the West would recognize. Now, to my mind, and I can understand that in certain countries and with certain societies, that perhaps man has become Hobbesian. I think, for example, in Bosnia, that it would be very difficult to imagine a classical liberal solution to Bosnia at the present time. But it seems to me that our role as philosophers, you mentioned earlier that in your work on the limits of liberty, you had abstracted from the existing situation. And it seems to me that if we are to make a contribution to the future of mankind, we have to abstract. And we have to work, in a sense, to my mind, on a model of human behavior, which I believe is achievable, and which would enable us to have liberty without license. So perhaps it's an empirical question. And, you know, it may turn out that John Gray is correct on this, but Singapore offends my classical liberal traditions. Mm-hmm. And one has to think that John Gray goes beyond Singapore. He talks about Tsarist Russia as being an acceptable civil society. He talks about Bismarckian Prussia as being an acceptable civil society. To my mind, these were not civil societies, and they were not certainly classical liberal civil societies.
I think one point you make in that last comment is very important, and that is somehow or another, I think it's obligatory on us, it's morally obligatory on us to proceed as if things are different from, and including people, including groups, are different from what we might empirically observe. I think to sort of generalize too quickly from the empirical reality out there gets us really bogged down in both in terms of concerns about what's happening and in terms of what might be the optimal policy or structure toward which we aim. We have to sort of impose in order to develop our norms, we more or less must impose that which we would set up as an ideal, so to speak, even though we recognize that people aren't like the ideal in one sense.
And a very good reason why we should do so is that we should not forget that every time that we acknowledge a defect that might lead to some kind of control, we open up the gates for those who are real Hobbesians mm-hmm. to move in. And for example, the tragedy of Oklahoma City. It's evident how quickly people were able to manipulate that situation, a kind of odd terrorist action, to try to argue for a massive increase in state intervention. And this, I think, is a very typical response, and it's a danger. And it seems to me, again, there is an empirical issue. When people like Gray concern themselves about different lifestyles and things which many of us might find offensive, he forgets, I think, a very important Victorian virtue, the virtue of toleration. Toleration does not mean that we agree with or accept a particular lifestyle. It means that we recognize the right of others to carry something out as long as it does not in any detailed way invade our own rights and privileges. And that notion of tolerance has very much disappeared from present discourse. And I think that's why we have so much upheaval in the discourse in the West, that people tend to think that anything which offends them in some psychological way is an externality which requires treatment. And you yourself in your early work noted that there are many externalities in the world, but most of them are not Pareto relevant. They're not significant enough to justify intervention. And I think that's the borderline. And that's why, for example, the recent discussions by Senator Dole on the issues of Hollywood have to be treated with great caution. Dole himself, I think, has been very careful not to suggest that his arguments against pornography and so on and rap music should lead to government controls. But he opens up the avenue for those who would like to introduce those controls. And it may be in some cases that if you live in a Hobbesian world and you really believe that people become so perverted by exposure to those activities that they threaten the livelihood of other individuals, that you may have to impose controls. That's the Lockean absence of license. But it may be in many other cases that it's purely psychological. And it was very interesting, for example, that Dole himself confessed he had not watched or read any of the material. So how would he really know what the impact would be if he hadn't actually exposed himself to it?
Well, that's related to the more general problem that John Gray and others raise. And quite frankly, I have never understood. I've never understood what the impact of the recognition of value pluralism, what is the implication of that? Now, it seems to me that we always live with value pluralism. That's what economics is all about, is reconciling different values, and anybody who makes choices does, in fact, live in a world of plural values and makes a choice and somehow combines these in enacting. That's just part of life itself. And I've never understood, I reviewed a book recently, the whole book was on value pluralism. I didn't have the remotest idea, nor did the author, about what was going on. And we had a conference here last year about it. And I came away based on John Rawls' more recent book, where he talks about a minimal consensus given the plurality of values. And I quite frankly don't understand what this philosophical discourse is all about. And Gray, of course, refers to Oakeshott and Berlin in particular as sort of exhibiting this set of notions about the importance of pluralism of values. But I don't know what's going on, quite frankly.
Well, I have given a little thought to it, and I think I know what's going on, and I think it's misconceived. It seems to me that value pluralism may well exist in a society, particularly one as diverse as America, with the different religions and ethnic groups and so on. But what better philosophy than classical liberalism to handle it? Because classical liberalism is really essentially concerned with protecting the individual from the invasion of his rights by others. And that seems to me to mean that if we have toleration, and it goes back to toleration within society, we have every possibility of that philosophy and a philosophy that led to a minimal state of the kind that I believe it should, being able to sustain value pluralism better than any other philosophy, certainly conservatism or socialism, that I know. And I think it goes to another point, that it's a question of what the starting point is with regard to society. Locke was quite clear on this, that we do not start with a political society. We start with a state of nature. And individuals, according to Locke's philosophy, are free never to enter into a civil society if they choose not to do so. Of course, they then would get none of the benefits from the civil society, and that would be the price they pay. Now, that gives you a very different notion, because that leaves you with the notion of the freedom to dissociate, which is as important as the freedom to associate. Yeah. But the political society, because of the indivisible nature of political decisions, tends to take that away from us. And that is the beauty of private markets, as Adam Smith noted in The Wealth of Nations. Yes.
I think that's very important. That whole notion, the political function of markets, is far more important than most people understand or give it credit for being. In the last few minutes, I'd like us to go back to where we started, really, and get a perspective on classical liberalism in the context of the modern setting, post the demise of socialism. I want to ask this question, see what you think about it. It seems to me that we're seeing now, as you know, a resurgence. You mentioned socialism in the small. We're seeing a resurgence of ideas which are basically mercantilist ideas. They've never gone away. They were present before the rise of socialism as a religion. And it's still our role as classical liberals to try to undermine those ideas. But the point I'm getting at and the question I want to raise and get you to speculate on a bit, how important was the ideological religious aspect of socialism in that century and a half when it was held dominant sway, especially amongst the intellectuals, and had influence on a lot of constitutional change and so forth? Now, if you pull away, as the fall of communism and socialism surely did, pull away the ideological substructure, and you're left with these rather bare mercantilist ideas, which were here before socialism and are here after socialism, how much more difficult is it going to be to sustain a de régis type regime with no underlying ideological support?
That's a very good question. It seems to me that you are absolutely right that the philosophical basis for socialism has disappeared, but to put it simply, the rent-seeking rationale for socialism is still there. And I think that what we see now as mercantilism is essentially an invasion of the political system to transfer wealth from some people to others. How is that to be combated? Let me go back to the dictionary. The saddest thing for me in working through the dictionary has been to look at the classical liberals of the 20th century, because of the five that I can identify as great classical liberals, it's only yourself who has a philosophical approach towards the issue. Now, of course, there are philosophers who are not economists, but they are weakened because they don't have the grasp of the economics. And it seems to me that if you do not have a moral position, a philosophical way of thinking about things, then you also are really in the turbulence of politics in the small. And most of our fellow economists, many of whom are free market, are not philosophers. You can think of Gary Becker, for example, as a very good example of that. And I think that their weapons, their method of persuading the young, falls back essentially on what's going to happen to the gross national product. And that seems to me to be a rather pathetic way in which to enter into our discourse.
Well, I realize your dictionary is probably going to have to stop, and you have to cut off at a certain period and get certain names. But one man who comes to mind, a young man, a young scholar, who probably would be, I doubt if he's in your dictionary, but he probably would qualify under the criteria that you've established, would be Richard Epstein. He seems to me, as he's developed further work, although he's a lawyer, a legal scholar, he he seems to me to be developing it from a fairly consistent perspective that would be called classical liberal, essentially.
I think that's a very good point, and I actually may go back and take that up in the late stages of the dictionary. The reason why I cut it off, essentially for people who are now aged 70 or upwards, is that there is a finite possibility that they'll change course. I mean, we've seen what's happened to Robert Nozick and to John Gray, but I do think that I have sufficient confidence in Richard Epstein to believe that he will not. Mm-hmm. He is a mixed classical liberal, because he is quite happy to kind of interpose Hobbesian with Lockean arguments. Yeah. But I do sense deep down, and this is why I'm attracted to the notion, that fundamentally he would die in a Lockean rather than a Hobbesian ditch.
Also, in a more practical sense, I'm a little concerned that he would be too much judicial activism. I would prefer the same institutional structure that he would like to see, but on the other hand, he would be quite happy to let the Supreme Court impose it, and that does concern me.
But then that goes back to the point that the dictionary has to be a breathing institution. Yeah. We can't necessarily impose our own individual views.
Well, this has been a good discussion, and I appreciate your joining with us, Charles. I think we haven't solved any questions, but at least we've raised some. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.